Scott Ray is VP of Government and Education Relations and Senior Public Key Infrastructure Architect at DigiCert. Scott is an expert in PKI implementations at all scales of implementation. He's also one of the leading voices for establishing scalable, standards-based trust for healthcare exchange. Currently, Scott serves as a board member for Direct Trust and co-chair of its Certificate Policies and Practices Working Group. His contributions to Direct Trust include becoming the leading force in private-public collaboration to realize the federal government's vision to make trusted federal healthcare exchange a reality. Please welcome Scott Ray to Cloud Developer Summit and Expo. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to talk today about securing digital identities. We are focusing in on healthcare. I think that Marty covered my credentials pretty well. We don't need to spend any time there. My day job, I work for DigiCert. They're a commercial certification authority. They specialize in identities, basically, on the web, whether that's services or whether it's for individuals as well. DigiCert is a global company in terms of high assurance credentials, I think ranked about number three. In terms of commercial certification authorities. We have been in this space in individual credentials in healthcare fairly heavily with our sponsorship and membership with Direct Trust, and a founding member of Direct Trust, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But the point of Direct Trust and the reason of why we want to focus on identities is to try and solve some of the issues that have come up with healthcare breaches. Private health information, or PHI, is probably that piece of data or that most folks consider probably the thing they want to hold closest and most precious to them. Certainly they don't want it to get into the wrong hands if they're seeking for insurance coverage. They don't want it to be used against them. And they don't necessarily want to broadcast to the world what health issues they might be having so that we are not targeted in any way for any deficiencies we might be experiencing. However, in the healthcare industry, there has been initiative within the US to move records, and the healthcare industry has been very slow behind other industries to do this, to move patient records in particular online or into a digital format, and there are incentives within government to do so. However, when we see headlines like those that I'm showing up on the screen here, it's perhaps a disincentive for folks to continue that initiative and push forward. And so some of the things that we have listed up here, we're seeing, since 2009, 29.3 million, that's about one-tenth of healthcare records have been breached. And that's, and since 2012, is a 138% increase, so it's not dying down. And in actual fact, you might actually say that parties who are malicious or nefarious in nature are recognizing the fact that medical records are moving online and they're looking for the opportunity to exploit that. And so we have to be really careful about how we do this. The other thing that is interesting about these stats is the only stats that are required to be reported is breaches that involve more than 100 individuals. Oh, sorry, 500 individuals. And so those stats don't actually represent the true amount of breaches that have actually occurred in healthcare. Digital, yes. Well, actually, more than digital. It's more than digital. So the other interesting thing here is under HIPAA, there are now some fairly good penalties for not having your systems in place. And so there's good incentives for those who are the custodian of healthcare data to protect that in a reliable way and make sure that when it's going to transition from them to somebody else, that that handoff is done in a secure manner. But if you look over on the right-hand side of the screen up there, this is data breaches across sector, and you can actually see that healthcare industry last year was where most breaches occurred as an industry. They actually overtook, it was education probably about 5 years ago. Now it's healthcare industry. So there are a number of different types. So the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Health and Human Services in this year have posed some breach incidents, and they categorize that, and you can see that the largest proportion of breaches come by theft. And typically, when it comes to theft, nobody's going to go carry out a stack of papers, which was the old style of storing your records. What you're finding now is they're going to carry out a hard drive, or they're going to carry out a laptop that held medical records in it, and that's where a lot of these thefts are occurring from. And two others that I wanted to note up there as well, hacking, so breaking into the transmission, or leveraging a vulnerability in the system where records are stored, as well as unauthorized access. And by unauthorized access, we're referring to, you know, in their normal course of workflow for medical records, someone might have access to them, but then to access them outside of that and use them for a purpose that they weren't authorized for. If you take those three groups together, that pretty much accounts for almost 80% of the breaches that occur for healthcare records. And so what I wanted to talk today was to focus on some technology and protocols that the Office of the National Coordinator has promoted, called Direct, is utilizing to address that scenario where data can be transferred securely, and even if the hardware gets stolen, it can still be secure, and there are ways to address that. And that's essentially what we want to focus on today. So, how do we guard against it? Well, there are technologies available to do this. The question really is do you have a good implementation? And that dovetails with all the rest of your security protocols to protect this particular data. So you can encrypt data at rest, and for encrypting, you know, that's ensuring that nobody has access to it unless they have the appropriate keys that allows it to be decrypted. So strong encryption protocols at rest or when it's being transmitted can keep data confidential. So even if the data is lost, as long as it's encrypted, then you can be relatively safe. You need strong authentication to access that data that has been encrypted. This is to address the unauthorized access. So you can't really control who has access to the data unless you know who is accessing the data at any point in time. So you need strong authentication of those identities. And of course, all of that dovetails down to ensure that at the beginning of the process, you have strong identity proofing to ensure that when a credential is issued, and there are different levels of assurance and credentials that are used as well, so again, you need to be using strong credentials. But when that credential is issued, so that when someone subsequently comes back to access this data, you know reliably that it was the original individual who was proofed for that. And so you need strong proofing all the way down. It's kind of like an inverted pyramid. If you don't do that strong proofing at the very beginning, then you don't necessarily have the strength in the credential that was issued that binds that identity and that is subsequently used, and then you don't necessarily have the strength in the access controls that then enables the encryption to do the protection that it needs to do. So it kind of all starts with identity, is the point. We're going to talk about the Direct protocol, and it's based on public key infrastructure, and you probably could have guessed by my particular background, that's really what we're talking about utilizing here. A lot of folks say that public key infrastructures are difficult to implement, and I don't believe that to be the case because I've been involved in many of them, but you do need to be meticulous, and if you don't dot all the I's and cross all the T's, then you can actually leave holes, which means you might have strengths in places, but you know, people can walk through the gaps that you've left. So you've got to make sure that you do it properly. I'm not going to go too much. I do have a number of slides up here. They're really for background, and I assume, Marty, that we will publish those, that folks can read them. But crypto is really just a bunch of numbers. And some key aspects here. The encrypt-decrypt is a function that allows you to hide and unhide information. Really started on the battlefield of, you know, commanders wanting to be able to give a message that even if the messenger got intercepted, that the enemy couldn't decode it and understand what their movements were. That's really where it started. But decrypt encrypt just means to hide or unhide in such a way that no one can read it unless they have the appropriate key. The keys really are just numbers. And in symmetric cryptography, the number is the same. It's a single key. The same key is used to encrypt as is to decrypt. But in asymmetric cryptography, they're different keys. They are related. but knowing one doesn't give you any information about the other. And so typically you take one and you keep it private, and you take the other one and you need to publish it widely. And the way that we publish it is we put it in a certificate that's signed by a trusted third party to say this is the key that belongs to this particular entity. And then we actually use a combination of that certificate and actually asymmetric crypto and symmetric crypto. And the reason for that is symmetric crypto is faster. Asymmetric is great if you're using small amounts of data. So you essentially exchange a small key, which is the symmetric key, using asymmetric crypto, and then use symmetric crypto, which makes it fast and efficient for doing this type of thing. So what goes into a certificate? You had a question? No, it's actually mandated SHA-2.
I'm sorry?
It's mandated SHA-2 within the direct protocol, I should say. So HIPAA says that you should have appropriate controls in place. They haven't necessarily specified what those are, but I'm going to talk about the direct protocol, which is kind of like secure email for healthcare records, if you like. And within the direct protocol, it is mandated for SHA-2. Yep. So a certificate, again, just contains details about the holder, the identity, what that certificate is used for, how long it's valid for, and that public key that needs to get distributed. The key aspect of the certificate is it's an identity binding process, so the trusted third party takes a reliable identification process to identify an entity, and they take that identity and they bind it with a set of keys that the entity provides for them, and they take the public key and put it in the certificate, and that gets published. So we talked before about encryption decryption. What's being showed up here is the asymmetric version where you have different keys. But essentially it's just hiding and unhiding data. And the way that we do things with those functions is we can sign a message. So electronic signing means that you take any message of any length and you hash it, and a hashing algorithm is a one-way function that creates a predetermined output. But even if you change one bit in the original message, it will significantly change the output that you get as a result. It's kind of like a signature or integrity check, if you like, of the original message. And essentially, when you want to digitally sign that, you actually take your private key, which only you will ever have access to, and you encrypt it. And that becomes the signature. And then if somebody wants to verify it, they take the original message, they do the same hashing algorithm that you did, so that they can see that the message hasn't changed, and they take the encrypted hash that the original signer did, they decrypt it with the public key of the signer, which is publicly available, and then they compare the two to make sure that they match. And that's how signing, and I've just walked through the verification process of the signature there as well. So PKI is good for a lot of things, actually. We can use it for authentication and authorization purposes. In the credentials, we can use it for secure messaging and electronic signatures that I just walked through, the data encryption that I already talked about, and protecting the actual networks themselves. So this brings me to the direct project, and essentially the direct project is really nothing more than secure email. It happens only on dedicated healthcare domains, and every direct address looks just like an email address, but the domain is actually managed by typically a covered entity or a covered entity under HIPAA or an entity that has a business associate agreement with a covered entity. The protocol started under the direct project in 2010, and really all the Office of the National Coordinator did was define the technology that was going to be used, and they recognized that, look, in order for this to work in practice, we are going to have some policies around how we implement this. But they punted on that because they wanted to get the technology done right. And so the purpose of Direct is to allow the electronic health records that are being promoted by the federal agencies and the federal government to ensure better care to customers are able to be exchanged, and to do that reliably. So you have a standard way of transferring them and using the technology to do that, but you still need some rules around who you want to trust and how you're going to trust them. And so out of the Direct project, a group was formed called the directtrust.org, and they set policies around how the implementation occurs so that you have standards and consistency and enable the trust from end to end. Direct Trust has a framework, it's standards based, it also has the policies, technologies, etc., and of course it's based on PKI. Direct Trust is a non-profit org. It's completely neutral, it's self-regulating, They do actually at this point have a grant from the Office of the National Coordinator to establish a national trust network for Direct so that there can be seamless use of the technology. One can understand that, you know, if we use email as an analogy, we can pick up an email, and if we know somebody's email address, we put it in and we send it off. And usually we don't think too much about whether it got there or not. If we get a response back, the context of the response will let us know if it got delivered. That obviously is not acceptable in the healthcare space. And so one of the things that the Direct Protocol does is it adds things to the standard RSC for SMIME that requires that there be notifications that come back that a covered entity that received it actually accepts responsibility for the payload that's being delivered. So within Direct Trust, the applicability to clouds is you have a healthcare organization and they have a number of addresses that they want to be able to utilize Direct for sending messages. They typically are going to, rather than implementing the infrastructure themselves, they will actually employ a, and this is a new term that was coined by ONC, a health information service provider, a HISP. So essentially HISP generally run cloud-based services that allows the users to log on and they take care of all of the mechanics of the transfer. In order to facilitate that, they have to rely upon strong identity, as I talked about earlier, and that is facilitated by use of certification authorities who do identity vetting. The RAs are the ones who are actually physically out there doing it. I'm actually going to skip over these because we want to get to some of the strengths of the protocol itself. As I mentioned before, a direct address, it looks just like an email address, other than the domain is dedicated to healthcare. And the other thing that's interesting is that certificates that are issued for use in Direct have to be issued by a CA that has been created only for Direct purposes. It can't be used, repurposed for any other purpose. It's for Direct only. So they have stovepiped that, so to speak. Sorry. So the certification authority that's actually issuing the certificate, and I should be careful here when if the use of the term CA, because CA could... So it's not the company. It's actually the... you have trust anchors, and I'm referring to a trust anchor here. So if I use a web analogy here, you look in your browser, you'll see some trust anchors that are trusted for verifying websites. So those trust anchors is what I'm referring to as the CA here, and so perhaps I should say the trust anchor. The trust anchor that issues direct certificates has to be dedicated to just issuing direct certificates. They didn't want any bleed over into any other community. So the Direct Trust has a certificate policy that determines how the certificates are issued, whose identity must be validated, how long they're good for, those type of things. And there are various different versions of certificates that you can get. Address certificates is used just for a single address, or you can have an organizational certificate which would cover any address that is under an organizational domain. And then you have device certificates, which is really about securing the infrastructure that it runs on, because essentially most of the time it's running over SMTP, although there is some use of SOAP services as well. As I indicated before, it just looks like a normal email address, except that it's really dedicated to healthcare. I'm not going to run through all the steps for how a direct message works, but I will say this. It works just like email. You need to know who you're sending to at the other end. One of the benefits that Direct Trust is working on right now is a set of directories that allows folks to find, you know, this provider at this healthcare organization has this direct address and rely upon that directory in order to be able to send to it. But the primary premise is that you need to know in advance what the address is. Then you can send an email just like it, or send a direct message just like an email, and you actually get a MDN back, a message disposition notification from the receiving party saying that they're accepting responsibility for the payload that's actually been sent. It could be SMTP all the way to the end, and so yeah, so it could be, or you could also do it via SOAP. There are actually a couple of protocols that can be used, but typically the transport in most cases is actually SMTP. And this is where we hopefully, one of the things I wanted to do here, so DigiCert is a commercial certification authority. We are that company, that's the CA. And so one of the things that we actually provide in this space is certificates that are not only direct compliant and certified. Direct has a certification program. It's the Direct Trust Agent Accreditation Program. It's run by ENAC, who's been doing certifications in healthcare space for a long time. So we're certified with ENAC, but we are also a Federal Bridge. The Federal Bridge CA is a PKI that was set up to actually bridge all the federal agencies and any person or organisation external to the federal government so that the federal government can rely on it.
Like SMIME type of...
These are an SMIME type of certificate.
So you have PKI connecting the A to Z send?
Yes.
Well,
so we don't do all of that, right? So yes. Yeah, so in that group that we talked about, the CAs, RAs, and HISPs, typically in the direct space right now, DigiCert's probably servicing about 80% of the market in terms of doing the CA piece and the RA piece, which is actually doing the identity vetting of the endpoints and issuing the certificate. Well, typically they do, but they're typically going to use a service, and they'll use a service from the HISP, from the Health Information Service. Yep, the HISP delivery service, yep. And so within our organisation, we have a portal, and we also have an API that allows the HISPs to request certificates from us, and we actually issue those certificates, and I did plan to run through the type of identity vetting process that we go through, but I think I'm going to skip over it in the interest of time, because one of the things that we did say that we would do here was actually give anybody who attended an opportunity to get an SMIME cert. It won't be direct, it would be for email, and I was actually going to run through that process because it's very similar, although I will say this, within the healthcare environment, there are a lot of other controls that we check. The certificate that I'll run through for the demo is just what I would call a level one credential. The only thing that is really being checked is that you have control of the email address that will be included in the certificate. That's a level one cert. Within Direct Trust, providers actually have to have a level three certificate, and a level three certificate means you're gonna check their association with an organization. You're gonna validate that their name, date of birth, address matches public databases, and they have to present a government-issued photo ID or some other photo ID and some other sort of corroborating identifying data like a bank account or utility bill, etc., that will be validated. So that's the... So the HISP has the responsibility to use level three certificates. It's the CA that's issuing the level three certificates, but they only do it after the RA has done the level three identity vetting. And the identity vetting that's specified in the Direct Trust policy at level three is typically following NIST 800-63 levels of assurance, because they have 1, 2, 3, 4, and we're doing level three. Yes, so DigiCert acts as a CA and RA, like I said, for about 80% of the HISPs that are actually operating in the market right now. And right now I think we have around about 50 odd HISPs that are within Direct Trust and certified within Direct Trust. And they cover probably most of the large EHRs that you can think of, et cetera. So yes, DigiCert as the RA, we will get a request from a HISP, because the HISP holds the private key. They need to do that to do the exchange. They get a request from us to say, look, we're assigning this key to this individual, and we need to know that this individual is who they claim to be. And so it's then our responsibility. And that was the piece that I was going to show you here, where we actually go and we request the data that we request is the full name, the date of birth and the address, and the photo ID. And then we validate the photo ID or corroborate the information that is there. Typically, for our services, we actually do that in person. That doesn't necessarily mean that an DigiCert employee is doing that. We're going to do the check on the background, on the back end at our offices, but we actually use a trusted agent in the field, and that's typically someone in the HR department of the organisation to which this individual belongs, and they're typically utilising records that already exist for I-9, etc., for employment, that type of stuff. So we have efficient ways and means of doing that. But one of the things that I wanted to do was actually, I'm going to hop out of this and give everybody an opportunity to get a level one certificate. And I forgot right at the beginning to send a little note around. And maybe we have a pad and a pen. And anybody who wants to get a level one certificate, which you can then use to secure your email, I just need an email address and a name written legibly. And then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what email, it doesn't matter if it's corporate, pop, MIME. So keep in mind though that it'll be a standard S/MIME certificate. It will run and it will operate on Android and on Apple, but we don't have enough time today for me to walk you through what you need to do to set your mail client up. You might have to figure that out at home. But what I will do today is I'll walk through the process so that you can see how the process works, and I'll issue myself a certificate. And then if you give me your email address, then I will pop that in and send a note to the system that will actually email you at your email address that you put in there, and it'll ask you to generate keys. And those keys are the keys that I was referring to previously. And then the public key out of that will actually be, is what gets sent back to us, and we issue the certificate in real time. And we can do that because it's just a level one. All we had to do was validate the email address. But then I'll show you how you can actually set that up with your email client so that whenever you send a message, it could actually be encrypted and signed so that nobody can read it along the way as they can currently. Because that's the plan. So the process that we will go through for that. So these, okay, awesome. I know we're going to run out of time today because I'm probably 1 minute away from where I need to finish. But these interfaces we make available to enterprises so that if you want to do this for enterprise, you can leverage a simple interface. So essentially, I'm going to go. Set of tools. We'll create what's called a personal ID. Goodness me, I can't do it on this screen. So, this certificate that I'll issue is actually can be used for document signing. It can be used for client authentication to websites. It can be used for email encryption and email signing. Now, keep in mind it's only level one, which means all it means is whoever owns this certificate has control of this email address, and that's it. So that would be the context if you use it to digitally sign a document. It would be the email owner, if you like, has signed this. It's really the only authenticity of the certificate that's being issued. Of course, your name will be in there, and you can communicate with somebody to say this is, you can rely upon it, and that's quite possible to do. And so, I've got a list of six names, I'm going to stick them in here, And I'll submit that, and then each of you will get an email. Within that email, I want to show you what that looks like, so I actually have to stick one in there. This is just a demo. And even though you see an option for SHA-1 and SHA-2 there, you can actually issue a SHA-1 up until the end of this year, I believe. But since I'm going to issue a one-year shirt to you, then, it has to be SHA-2. If it was after next year, it's actually going to default to SHA-2 anyway, because it won't let you do it. But so if I'm going to issue a cert to myself, for instance, and I'll do this one. So HEBCA is the Higher Education Bridge Certification Authority. We're going to issue that for 1 year. And then, you guys won't see this, so I'm going to have to drag across my email here in just a sec to show you what it looks like. And you will get something that looks. And here we're going to see that. Gee, why can't it scroll? Let's see. Let me drag it this way. So you'll get something that, came back here. That's the problem. So you'll get something that looks like this. And it says you've been approved for a certificate. Contact me if you've got any questions. You'll click on this link. Which if you do, I've already installed that certificate. That was my previous link. I didn't click on my new one. There we go. That's my new one. The new email that I just got. And you'll get something that'll pop up like this that says, you have to agree to a subscriber agreement, the usual fluff. Now, keep in mind that my default browser here that I'm demonstrating is Firefox. You'll have a slightly different experience in Internet Explorer, a slightly different experience in Safari, if that's what you're using. What I will tell you is this interface that this particular demo was hooked up to right now, you should not do natively on your phone. You should actually do it on a laptop because we haven't plugged in the API for pushing it into the iPhone or SCEP to push it into Android. So do it on your laptop and then you can transfer it. You actually just send yourself an email to the phone and install it. But I can give you. Yes, so if you're going to send message from the phone, there's also a bit of mucking around that you need to do to set one of these things up as well. I could have shown you how simple it was to. And that's pretty much it. It was done that quick in terms of generating the certificate. And then if I were to show you what the certificate looked like, it's basically just going to have my name with that email address that I put in there and to say that it was a demo from DigiCert and it's good for a year. And then you set that up with your email client and you can actually send someone an encrypt email back and forth. So I have six here and you guys, six, Your names will, you'll get an email just like that, and you can go through a process just like that. And then in terms of what to do next to configure it with the email client, feel free to send me a call and I can perhaps step you through the process. That's probably the easiest thing to do at this point. I know that we're over and I'm between you and drinks, but if anybody has any questions about Direct and the use of PKI to secure healthcare records, I'm happy to take one or two if we have time, Marty. I know we've had a few questions along the way. Yes. So one of the interesting issues and one of the reasons why the creation of the Health Information Service Provider, the HISP, I said right at the beginning, I don't think PKI is a difficult thing. But that's because I'm used to it and I've done a lot of it. But for somebody to have to walk through a lot of steps, you do have to walk through a lot of steps to set up an application. And the idea behind, as we were just seeing, but the idea behind the Health Information Service Provider is they obfuscate and take that away. You can provide a service so that all they have to do is log on to their normal electronic medical record system, provider does, and you know they have access to Direct within that. And the same for patients. They can log into their patient portal and they would have access to send direct messages. And the HISP is obfuscating all the things that you need to do to set up and then to send the messages backwards and forth. So it just becomes another messaging app, basically, that you signed in and have access to within your EMR or within your EHR or your PHR, depending, you know, what type of entity you are. If you're going to do this for email, there are quite a few steps that you will need to set up. So the six of you who will get one of these certificates, you might have to go through a few steps to set this up, either in your operating system if you're going to use it for authentication to websites, or within your email client if you're going to use it for signed encrypted email, and even within something like, if you set it up for your operating system, it'll work pretty much in Office for signing Word documents, it'll work in Adobe for signing documents, etc. You have a little bit of setup to do in Adobe as well. But once you've done the setup, it basically, from that point on, it's click a button to sign stuff, and it's very simple. So there is some setup to happen, and to not put that burden of setup on providers or patients, that was why they created the Health Information Service Providers, to do that work for them. And so the HISP manage all of the certificates, and all you have to do is authenticate to the HISP service, and then, I want to send this message here, and the HISP takes care of that for you. But to do it manually, you can still do it manually for S/MIME because it's the same protocols, other than with S/MIME, you don't actually get a message back to say that they accepted it, which you do get with the HISP. That's a requirement of HISP to accept the responsibility for messages. So I can actually walk you through all those setup pieces so you can actually see this working. But again, the purpose of Direct was to utilize a HISP so that you wouldn't have to do that. You basically sign up for the service, you get authenticated, the credential gets created at the HISP, and they manage everything for you. And they typically do that on a cloud basis. Any other questions? We actually have encountered a little bit of resistance. A lot of folks, in order to be certified with Direct Trust, it's actually quite a lot to go through, the HISPs themselves. Generally, it takes it's a few months, really, to go through the process, because if you're a HISP, a certified HISP either has to run their own CA and RA process, or they have to use an accredited CA and someone who's already accredited, so they could outsource that portion to somebody who's accredited. If you're going to do all three, that's a lot of work. If you're an RA, then there's industry standard type certifications that you go through. And the DTAP RA, there's probably around about 50 odd criteria that you actually have to meet and demonstrate that you meet. It requires an on-site visit to verify that you meet them. So you've got to have policies in place, and then you've got to demonstrate that you're actually following those policies around identity vetting. And then on top of that, the RA piece is another 65 of those that you've got to show as a CA that you have these policies in place and that you're actually meeting those requirements. And all of the policies are created on the basis of being HIPAA compliant all the way down. And so then the HISP on top of that, you know, then has a bunch more requirements that they've actually got to meet to show that they are using the right protocols and that they can actually send the right messages back, et cetera, et cetera. So those things are actually defined in DTAP, so the Direct Trust Agent Accreditation Program. And that's a certification that ENAC, which is the Electronic Healthcare Network Accreditation, don't know what the C is, company, maybe it's not company, but ENAC, E-H-N-A-C. So ENAC runs the DTAP certification. ENAC and Direct Trust defined the certification, and it was signed off by ONC. And so once you're certified as a HISP, that means the services that you're using for CA and RA are also certified as well. And that process can actually take some time. And there are changes to the process over time, and you actually have to stay in step. And one of them that you brought up before was, you know, what SHA algorithms, what hashing algorithms are you using and are acceptable? So, you know, SHA-2 is a requirement. When we first started out, SHA-1 was allowed, but, you know, back in 2010, that was fine. But as of since 2012, no. They are. They went through a difficult transition. And right now, I should point out that there are a couple of federal agencies that have actually joined Direct Trust, and they're still in the process of implementing for Direct and utilizing a HISP. Some of them are outsourcing the HISP portion to commercial entities, and some of them are actually building their own and running it internally. But the federal agencies, the Federal Health Architecture, is a group that's run. It consists of Social Security, the VA, Department of Defense, Indian Health Service, ONC, obviously, which is the Office of National Coordinator, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I think that's all of the agencies that are participating in the how should we implement Direct for federal agencies. They've actually come out with a set of controls that are actually stronger than what Direct Trust requires. For instance, one of their controls is, in order for the federal agency to rely upon a Direct certificate, it can't just be a vanilla Direct Trust certificate. It actually also has to be cross-certified with the federal bridge, which is one of the reasons why DigiCert has been successful in this space, because the credentials that we're issuing meet that criteria. So folks know if they get a certificate from us, then the federal agencies are going to trust it when they come on board. That was one of the requirements that was different. That's not a requirement within Direct Trust. And then at the HISP level, there are also a number of other requirements that need to be met, because within the federal space, federal agencies also have to meet FSMA. They also have to meet the NIST standards, et cetera. And so some of those put restrictions on what protocols, algorithms, et cetera, the HISP can be using. So within Direct Trust, you can be a little more broader, but if you're going to deal with a federal agency, you actually have to be a little more fine-tuned in what you actually support, and you have to actually demonstrate that. And so there will be a trust bundle that, if that trust anchor is in the trust bundle, any certificate signed by that trust anchor will be trusted by the federal agency. So essentially there'll be a federal trust bundle, and it will consist of a subset of what is currently the Direct trust bundle. And by trust bundle, I mean really nothing more than that group of CAs that you usually see in your browser that's automatically trusted for doing transactions. That's kind of the output of the DTAP program. You get certified by DTAP, you get into the trust bundle, and then you're trusted to do the exchange in a reliable way. That's the way the process works. And you're audited against that every 2 years.
So if
in terms of securing the keys, yes, you have, there are, it's level two actually for securing the keys is all that's required. At DigiCert, we actually prefer folks to use level three, but you know, the federal standard says level two is sufficient, so that's okay. So that's one of the things. The other thing is you have to follow FIPS 186, which is a digital signature standard, so that says which algorithms are allowed to be used, and it's, you know, a little more confined than what Direct Trust would allow. Direct Trust would allow you to use more than those type of things. So yeah, all of those things come into play for the federal agencies. And if you go to healthit.gov and you look under, there's some federal advisory committees, the FACAs, then there's within that the FHA group is defined, and on that site they've actually published what the requirements are for federal agencies in terms of direct. So they've made recommendations, but right now today I don't know of any federal agency that is actually what I would call widespread production. There's pilots that are doing this, but it's not broad spread because they're still building their set of trust anchors. They can certainly communicate with themselves internally, but the whole idea of this is to be able to, and one of the motivations for this, I'll use the example of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. They today have about $50 billion a year in mispayments or wrong payments for Medicare and Medicaid. And part of the reason for that is there's no pre-authorization. Basically, the work gets done and then claims get submitted, and sometimes claims get duplicated, etc. And so sometimes the work shouldn't have been done, and sometimes the work gets billed twice, but you add it all up and they got $50 million worth of $50 billion of this a year. And part of what they plan to do with direct is they can actually now implement, if they have direct, a pre-authorization. So as long as there is, if you have to wait for a paper trail to go backwards and forth between you and CMS, which what happens today, they only review about 10% of claims and the rest just get automatically paid. That's why there is so much wastage. But if you had a pre-authorization, the only way you could do that is if you had an electronic system that you could rely upon. And so claims can be sent to CMS, they can pre-authorize it, and they believe that they can bring that $50 billion down to perhaps millions of dollars, which is a massive saving for the government. So there's really good incentives for implementing the technology. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so